Today's broadcast was originally recorded on June 5th, 2024.
The Texas Republican Convention met over the weekend, and the delegates there embraced a number of stances which signaled a rightward shift for the party's philosophy moving forward.
Well, that's a nice way to put it. A rightward shift moving forward. Don't be alarmed.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Why?
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Melody.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am from Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. This is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. Desi Doyen, how are you feeling? Are you feeling better?
I am feeling better, but of course I still sound a little stuffed up.
You're testing negative, are you?
I am these days? All clear.
And can you believe the miracle that I have yet to catch it this time? That
knock
you have
on wood.
Not infected me this time as you did last time?
Not yet.
Not that I'm still angry about that at all. But anyway, good. Glad to hear it. Thank you. Happily, there were a few, is something else to be happy about. Few, if any, reported problems so far, at least that I've been able to find, for voters at primary polling places on Tuesday in five states: Iowa, Montana, New Jersey, New Mexico, South Dakota, and the District of Columbia. This marks, you're going to be sad about this, Des, the last week of the 2024 presidential primary contest.
Wow.
Or at least it will be the last of them once Democrats caucus in Guam and hold a primary in the Virgin Islands this coming weekend. So that's about it. Among those states holding presidential contests on Tuesday, despite both President Biden and former president, now convicted felon Donald Trump, having already won the needed number of delegates to be named as their party's respective nominees at the conventions this summer, there were still signs of residual dissatisfaction, I should say, on both sides of the aisle. Take Montana, for instance. Yes, the very red state of Montana, where you might expect Donald Trump to do very well. Well, he did well, I guess, with 91% of the vote on Tuesday, but just over 9% of Republican voters registered no preference on their Republican primary ballot. Still, 91% seems like it's pretty good. In fact, Joe Biden actually outperformed Donald Trump in Montana among Democratic voters, who gave the president just over 92% of the vote, with no preference, the no preference line winning just under 9%. Both pretty close, though one might expect Donald Trump to outperform Joe Biden in an otherwise very red state, even if the state, yes, does have a Democratic U.S. senator. That would be John Tester, who is up for a very tough re-election this year. He easily won his renominating contest on Tuesday with 97% 5% of the Democratic vote. And he will now run against businessman and former Navy SEAL Tim Sheehy, who easily won the Republican nomination on Tuesday to challenge Tester against two other challengers in what will be one of the most closely watched and critical elections for Democrats this year if they hope to hold on to their bare majority in the U.S. Senate. Also, in the great state of New Mexico, both presidential candidates ran into some headwinds, with Trump picking up about 85% of his party's vote, with the rest of the voters there on the Republican side, about 15%, going for the ghost campaigns of Nikki Haley, Chris Christie, and to the uncommitted line. While on the Democratic side, Joe Biden picked up nearly 84% of the vote in New Mexico, with uncommitted carrying nearly 10%. And Marianne Williamson garnering almost 7%.
Oh, yeah, she's still running.
Yes, she is. The ghost of Marianne Williamson, although I think she's actually still running.
I think so.
I don't know. I'm thinking her chances may not be very good this fall. Donald Trump either wasn't on the ballot or he ran uncontested in the other states that voted on Tuesday, where, for example, in a very low turnout Democratic primary in South Dakota, low turnout because there ain't many people or Democrats in the state. Joe Biden picked up just about 75% of the vote in South Dakota, with various assorted also-rans winning, well, splitting the rest of the vote, which amounted to less than 5,000 votes, according to the reported unofficial tallies today. In the very Democratic-leaning District of Columbia, Biden took 87% of the vote, with just, 78% counted as we go to air today, so that could change. Marianne Williamson, yes, took over 4%. And assorted write-in votes apparently won more than 7% of the vote there in D.C. And in New Jersey, the president won almost 89% of the vote, with uncommitted, which has been serving as a stand-in of sorts in states that offer that ballot line for protest votes against Joe Biden's position on Israel. Well, uncommitted picked up nearly 9% of the votes in New Jersey, with 93% unofficially reporting as of airtime. But while Trump ran uncontested on the Jersey ballot himself on Tuesday, he did run into some headwinds in the Garden State. In the race to fill the U.S. Senate seat of criminally charged Democratic and currently on trial for corruption Robert Menendez, on the Democratic side, party-supported New Jersey Congressman Andy Kim easily coasted to victory against two challengers, while on the Republican side for the U.S. Senate nomination for that seat, in what is very unusual for this primary cycle to date, the candidate endorsed by Donald Trump, Christine Serrano Glassner, actually went down to an unexpected defeat to the GOP establishment-backed real estate developer Curtis Bashaw in a four-way Republican contest. He will now face Andy Kim in November. So that race in the otherwise very Democratic-leaning state, as we discussed on yesterday's broadcast, that U.S. Senate race, could be complicated by the announcement this week by the long-serving, now former Democrat, Robert Menendez's announcement this week that he hopes to run for his seat, his current seat, which he has refused to resign from despite pleas from Democrats after he was federal charges, corruption charges were brought against him. He has decided to run as an independent this year for U.S. Senate in New Jersey, at least, he says, if he is acquitted during his ongoing corruption and bribery trial for doing favors for Egypt while chair of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee in exchange for cash and gold bars and a Mercedes-Benz and a high-paying job for his then-girlfriend, who is now his wife, who is also facing felony charges with Robert Menendez. His son, Robert Menendez's son, Congressman Rob Menendez, by the way, he easily won his primary on Tuesday against two Democratic challengers, though prosecutors have not connected the younger Menendez to his father's corruption and bribery scandal. It has still dogged the House Democrat during his reelection bid, understandably, but really not enough, apparently, to unseat him in the primary on Tuesday. For the most part, incumbents held on in all five states on Tuesday, whether it was for Congress or state contests, etc., winning their respective parties' nominations despite challenges usually from the right on the Republican side against many of them. But incumbents were able to hang on. With two presumptive presidential nominees now both seeing protest votes of various sort persisting as the presidential primary finally winds down, with party conventions to set to begin on the Republican side next month. Next month, Desi Doyen.
I know.
In Milwaukee. Just 4 days after Donald Trump is sentenced for his 34 felony convictions in New York State, where a jury of his peers unanimously found he falsified documents to cover up hush money payments to a porn star to help him, yes, rig the 2016 presidential election in his favor. So that'll be just before the Republican National Convention begins.
It should be interesting.
Up there in Wisconsin. Yes, of course. Interesting is a very nice way to put it. May you live in interesting times, as the Chinese curse goes. That's right. As always, the results covered here on the day after the election, they're all unofficial. They're all subject to change once they are all canvassed and confirmed in the coming days. And as sometimes occurs, any problems during tabulation comes to light, which can sometimes take days or weeks or even longer, as none of the results that we just covered have actually been confirmed by any actual human beings at this point. Of course, there were other races on the ballots on Tuesday, including both congressional and state and local races, which, as I hope to discuss with my guest joining me momentarily from Texas, Desi's home state,
yep,
can often tell us much more about the direction of our national politics, these state races. Can tell us more about the direction that the nation is going politically than the contests at the top of the ticket actually do. That is particularly true in recent years on the Republican side. Because, for example, what happens in Texas, currently controlled by far-right Republicans who hold majorities in both chambers of the state legislature and hold every single statewide office, as well as every seat on the state Supreme Court. What happens there, very decidedly in Texas, does not stay in Texas these days. Here's just the latest example of that. Arizona lawmakers voted on Tuesday to put a Texas-inspired immigration referendum on the November ballot, which is, according to Washington Post, the latest effort by Republican state leaders to challenge federal authority on enforcing border security. The measure will ask voters whether they want to direct state and local law enforcement agencies to arrest those who they believe have crossed the border illegally. The resolution mimics Texas's Senate Bill 4 and is similar to a bill recently signed into law in Louisiana, which also mirrors the arguably unconstitutional Texas scheme that seems to overstep federal law. It's being challenged in federal court by the Biden administration. Nonetheless, in the past year, the Iowa and Oklahoma legislatures have also enacted laws that mirror parts of the controversial Texas law, which is being challenged in court, as I noted. Meanwhile, lawmakers in Tennessee, Florida, Georgia, all Republican-controlled states, adopted measures to more easily penalize and report undocumented immigrants to federal authorities. The referendum in Arizona could have broader implications in a critical swing state, in the presidential election this November. Republicans are counting on drawing to the polls voters who are upset over President Biden's handling of border security, even as the disgraced and convicted former president ordered Republicans in Congress to abandon a bipartisan border security measure that they had hammered out with Democrats that would have been the toughest ever established. Why? Well, because, as Trump has said, he needs to run on the idea that there is chaos at the U.S. Southern border, and he won't have anything to do with anything that might actually, you know, solve that problem that he claims to be threatening the nation. The Arizona measure is likely to fire up opposition, however, from the same groups that helped Democrats win big back in 2020 in Arizona by standing against yet another controversial immigration-related state bill. As proposed, Arizona's Secure the Border Act will make crossing the border illegally a state crime and allow state judges to order deportations, something that's usually left to the federal government. The proposal is a compilation of various border measures that were all rejected by Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs earlier this year. Republicans are expecting voters to support it. We'll see if they're right about that. Critics say the referendum is a desperate attempt by Republicans to gin up voter turnout in an election year that may wipe away their thin majorities in both legislative chambers. Right now, I think they have just one vote majorities in both the House and Senate in Arizona. Arizonans could have to slog through at least a dozen proposed measures on the ballot this year. Democrats who oppose the immigration bill are worried that voters will unwittingly choose to approve the measure to get through an exceptionally long ballot quickly without understanding the full consequences. But I will also note that all of these measures on the Arizona ballot this fall, thanks to those GOP-adopted policies that were vetoed by the state's Democratic governor, all of those extra measures that are usually not there is likely going to add an additional page, an additional piece of paper to each ballot for voters this November, which is kind of freaking out some of the election officials because it's going to require some changes to their current optical scan tabulator programming, as if Arizona election officials don't have enough to worry about this year. But we'll get to that concern, I suspect, on another day. So this ballot measure is based on Texas legislation after it was vetoed by the Arizona state's Democratic governor. But there is no Democratic governor in Texas. In fact, there is no Democrat in any statewide seat, and there hasn't been for some 30 years at this point. Nonetheless, a horrifying state GOP party platform has just been approved by Republicans that calls for a measure that could prevent any Democrat from ever being able to hold office again in the Lone Star State. I'm not kidding. And there's good reason to think that that scheme that the state Republicans are now calling for in Texas and some pretty other appalling and radically extreme stuff that is in the party's new 50-page platform in Texas might also spread to other GOP-controlled states as well. Are members of the media taking such party platform documents as seriously as they should, as the roadmap that they are apparently offering us to Republican extremism in recent years? Austin, Texas-based journalist Andrea Grimes joins us next to discuss and, frankly, to warn about exactly that. So you don't want to miss this conversation, if only to know what autocratic nightmares we all may be talking about in the years ahead as the Republican Party continues its unabated rush to the far, far, yes, far right. That's straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. Hey, this is Brad here at the Bradcast and bradblog.com. We fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. Please help us continue that fight over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
The eyes of Texas are upon you all the livelong day.
Yeah, they are.
The eyes of Texas are upon you. You cannot get away.
Well, some might want to get away from Texas. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Perhaps our eyes should be on Texas. As we have been plowing through the primary season in recent months, of course, aside from problems for voters at the polling place, the results at the top of the tickets for the presidential nominations, of course, have received the most attention on this show and certainly in the broader national media. Next, attention has been given to House and Senate primaries and a number of statewide contests. Receiving far less attention, of course, are usually the races for state and local government. But in fact, that's where much of the governing action actually happens around the country. And what happens at the state and local level, particularly at state legislatures in recent years, particularly in Republican-dominated state legislatures, has increasingly served as a roadmap toward what is to come for our national politics. State governments in the U.S., long, of course, being regarded as our so-called laboratories for democracy at the national level, but now more than ever, I think. And in the case of Republican politics, what has been happening at the state level might better be seen not just as a laboratory, but as a warning sign for our democracy. And there may be no better warning sign than what we saw in the great state of Texas recently, when the latest round of primary and runoff elections saw 15 incumbent Republican state House members lose to even farther right challengers. Texas's far-right Republican House Speaker Dade Phelan managed to squeak by in his recent primary runoff election by less than 400 votes against an even farther-right challenger who had Donald Trump's endorsement, as well as those of Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick and its Attorney General Ken Paxton and the most recent party chairman Matt Rinaldi. Rep. Tony Gonzalez, the Republican U.S. congressman who represents Uvalde, where the mass shooting of 19 children and two adults took place in 2022, barely won his runoff against a gun zealot who refers to himself as the AK guy, reference to his fondness for Kalashnikov assault rifles. Both Phelan and Gonzalez were censured last year by their own state party. The speaker's punishment was for a, quote, lack of fidelity to Republican principles and priorities, unquote, after the GOP-dominated state house impeached Republican Attorney General Ken Paxton for massive and well-documented corruption. The state Senate, which includes Paxton's wife as a member, subsequently refused to convict him. On the other hand, the congressman's reprimand was for a handful of heresies, including his vote for some very modest gun law changes in the wake of the massacre at Robb Elementary School in his home district of Uvalde. Lest rank-and-file GOP voters ever again be allowed to override the activists who run the party machinery, the Texas State Republican Convention held last week approved a new rule preventing any candidate who is censured by the party from appearing on the ballot for 2 years. That should keep them in line. But that's just the beginning. Or at least it's the logical extension of where the Texas State Republican Party, and frankly, many other state Republican parties at this point around the country, have long been heading. We should have and could have known had we paid closer attention to state party politics, often spelled out for us as a guidebook or a roadmap by their official party platforms that few, certainly few in the national media, but too often in local and state media as well, regard as little more than unattainable statements of principle by the party's most radical members, the party's fringiest. Looking for something really hair-raising to read? Check out the 50-page platform that was just adopted by the Texas Republican Party, writes Washington Post's Karen Tumulty this week, before seemingly undermining her own premise. Quote, "The document approved at the party's biennial convention in late May is not a serious policy roadmap," she says. Are you sure about that? "But it does reveal the id of a political party that has gone off the deep end," she warns. Just a few of the party's platform planks highlighted by Tumulty: that the Bible should be taught in public schools with chaplains on hand, quote, "to counsel and give guidance from a traditional biblical perspective based on Judeo-Christian principles," unquote. That non-citizens who are legal residents of this country should be deported if they are arrested for participating in a protest that happens to turn violent. That name changes to military bases should be reversed to, quote, "publicly honor the Southern heroes." Southern heroes, by the way, who waged a war in favor of slavery against the United States of America. That doctors who perform abortions should be charged with homicide, that the U.S. should withdraw from the United Nations, and that the international organization should be removed from U.S. soil. Then there is this audaciously undemocratic provision, notes Tumulty: to be elected to statewide office, a candidate must win not only a majority of votes, but also more than half of Texas's 254 counties. Yes, they must win majorities in more than half of those counties in order to win statewide. Tumulty translates what that means. She explains, "Democrats in Texas are concentrated in a few urban areas, while Republicans are spread across the map. This system," she said, "would effectively mean Democrats, who, as it is, have not won statewide office since 1994, would be shut out forever." But again, remember, Tumulty reminded us right at the top of this article, right at the top of this, that the platform, while, quote, "off the deep end," as she described it, is, quote, "not a serious policy roadmap." So, you know, don't worry about it. Dismissing Republican Party platforms in states like Texas isn't only a time-honored tradition by national media outlets. As Austin-based journalist and activist Andrea Grimes observed on Friday in an opinion column for MSNBC, the chief political reporter for the Austin American-Statement called the state Republican Party's recently adopted platform, quote, "more of a wish list for the most activist members of the GOP than a roadmap that will be followed by lawmakers in Austin or Washington." Even the Texas Tribune's otherwise thoughtful, comprehensive reporting on the recent party convention, she notes, describes the party platform as, quote, "traditionally seen not as a definitive list of Republican stances, but a compromise document that represents the interests of the party's various business, activist, and social conservative factions." Well, sure, all of these planks may sound crazy, but it's all just a way to rally the party's fringiest and most faithful, right? Well, not so, especially in Texas, explains Grimes, who has been covering GOP state party conventions in the Lone Star State for nearly 15 years now. She argues the dismissal by media, even local media, who ought to know better by now, of GOP party platforms in recent years as little more than statements of general principle from the party's fringiest elements, just roadmaps as opposed to serious policy guidance, is, quote, "patently incorrect and contradicted by demonstrable evidence that the Texas GOP platform has been driving policy in Texas and beyond, not just recently, but for several years now." She argues that the media do a disservice by having failed to learn that lesson and properly warn the electorate, not just in Texas, but across the nation. Joining us now is Andrea Grimes, an Austin-based journalist, activist, and podcaster whose work has appeared in the New York Times, the Texas Observer, Rewire News, Cosmopolitan, Bitch, Dame, Ms., and Jezebel, and last week at MSNBC, among other media outlets. Andrea Grimes, thank you for joining us today on the broadcast.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, before we get to how and why you regard coverage by both national and state media outlets as missing the boat on these on this party platform, these documents by missing it by a mile, let's first platform the platform, so to speak, so folks really do get a sense of how both crazy and, I guess, crazy like a fox, pun intended here, that the latest party platform for the Texas GOP actually is. Your MSNBC headline describes it as a terrifying preview of MAGA's future. So what policy prescriptions do you find to be the most terrifying elements of this 50-page really manifesto that Americans must know about?
Yeah, well, there's a whole lot to unpack there. So the parts of the platform that I find the most immediately terrifying are the ones that are the most likely to be enacted in some way or another in the near future or even in the next 5 or 10 years. Most notably, of course, the classification of abortion as homicide, which is something that Republicans and the anti-abortion lobby have been pushing for at least really nearly a decade now. Mm-hmm. But was made impossible by the existence of Roe v. Wade. Of course, now that Roe v. Wade is no longer a legal precedent and the law of the land, there is a lot more leeway to criminalize abortion. Mm-hmm. And in the most recent platform, the Texas GOP lays it out straight. They say abortion is not healthcare, it is homicide. And homicide is punishable by the death penalty in Texas and in a lot of other states. And, you know, Texas Republicans have filed abortion death penalty bills in years past. Mm-hmm. I can think of examples from 2017, 2019, and 2021, but they've never gotten past committee. And unfortunately, the one thing we know about Texas Republicans, as we can see in the platform itself, is that they are persistently dedicated to their worst and most terrifying ideas. And, you know, much like the anti-transgender bathroom, quote unquote, bathroom bills we saw in 2013 and 2015 that eventually became laws later in the 2010s, I think there's a real strong possibility that abortion as homicide bills are going to start making it out of committee. They may start making it to the floor of the Texas legislature. I know that Republicans in other states, South Carolina, Louisiana, Alabama, Kentucky, have tried similar efforts as well. Mm-hmm. So I think we are only a couple of years from seeing serious debate and maybe even passage in a state house for abortion as homicide legislation. So that's really one of the scariest ones I can think of.
I will respond to that by my own thought on what caught my eye. You know, we focus a lot on democracy on this program and the need for free, fair, and transparent elections with public oversight as, you know, the ultimate sort of way to keep our constitutional republic on track, the ultimate corrective here, I guess. But when it is warped, as it is by this proposal in Texas, that winners of statewide office must win in a majority of counties. I mean, even if the horrific things you're talking about are able to be passed, you know, one of the solutions is to get new leaders in there. But you can't get new leaders in there if they make it impossible to do that. Is that really a proposal that we should take seriously, that you can't win for, you know, governor or senate or anything else unless you win a majority of the counties in Texas?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I just don't think there's truly anything in the document that the party wouldn't ultimately go for if they thought that their funding or their elections were on the line, right? And so the you know, Democrats have begun gaining power in Texas's urban centers mm-hmm. for a long time now, right? Dallas is blue, Houston is blue, Austin is blue, San Antonio is blue, the Rio Grande Valley is blue, El Paso is blue, even Tarrant County, where Fort Worth is, mm-hmm. my home county, mm-hmm. has gone blue, right? So, you know, Republicans are scared because they are seeing that these large population centers have the ability to really influence statewide elections. And this county by county proposal is, of course, this fantastic, and I mean that in the most literal sense, a fantasy, right? That uh-huh. land could outvote Texans, right?
Right.
because, you know, the land that they're talking about, and, you know, I'm not sure how much your listeners have spent time driving around Texas, but the vast majority of Texas's 254 counties yep. are rural, sparsely populated. You know, we're talking desert, we're talking ranchland, we're talking mountains out in the west, right? We're talking plains up in, you know, the panhandle, right? You know, so I think that Republicans perhaps think that proposing this under the guise of, you know, giving the majority of counties a say will dupe voters and others into thinking that they're being reasonable, right? Yeah. When anyone who understands anything about the geography of Texas, you know, can see on its face that this is an attempt to, you know, sort of stymie back mm-hmm. what they are seeing in the blue cities, which is bluer and bluer and bluer voters all the time.
And for the record, we have driven across Texas. It is huge. We often, you know, repeat the phrase as we're driving, the sun has riz, the sun has set, and here we is in Texas yet. But, you know, why I find that that particular platform plank, you know, mandating that statewide office holders have to win a majority of counties, why I find it to be chilling is not only because what it would do in Texas, there are a lot of states that not as large, but are sort of similarly situated where you have the, you know, the Democrats in the city centers and the Republicans in these sparsely populated areas. You know, around the rest of the state. And therefore, with this idea in Texas, what happens in Texas in recent years, unfortunately, does not stay in Texas. It spreads like a virus to other, you know, GOP-controlled states. This week, for example, Arizona is attempting to pass an initiative to put an initiative on the ballot this year, I believe, for a Texas-style anti-immigrant law, giving state and local law enforcement officials the ability to arrest and deport those that they believe are in the country mm-hmm. unlawfully. And so, you know, that seems to be part of the reason why, as you write, you are concerned about the way these radical platforms are covered by the media. You write that you have been covering these state GOP conventions in Texas since 2010. Since the Tea Party years, and that your own editors have somewhat misled you about how they should be covered. How so?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I wrote on MSNBC, the first GOP convention that I covered was in 2010 in Dallas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm sort of a fresh-faced reporter ready to go out there and collect my man on the street interviews and see what's happening at this wacky convention. Yeah. And, you know, the warning I got from my, I mean, extremely talented, very kind, sweet, like educated editors was, this is going to be a nut show. You will see the wildest stuff you've ever seen in your life. These people aren't to be taken seriously. Mm-hmm. They are the fringe Republicans of the base. They are there because they are the truest true believers, and you really shouldn't take much of what they say seriously. And I went in with that mindset, mm-hmm. But also with a little voice in the back of my head that was like, but I know these people. Like, I'm related to some of these people. Right. Like, I grew up among these people. Uh-huh. I founded my high school Young Republicans Club. I remember what it is like to believe as they do, right? Mm-hmm. And so I really sort of had a feeling at the time of, like, this goes against my better judgment. This perspective goes against my better judgment. But if these old white guy editors are telling me this, they must be right. Mm. And, you know, my coverage is snarky and funny and whatever, mm-hmm. but I was deeply unsettled by the experience. And then the more I got into covering Texas politics over the years, and I've always worked for sort of lefty, nonprofit, progressive publications, mm-hmm. You know, the more it became pretty clear to me that these people weren't messing around. These are not pipe dreams. It's not, you know, fantasies. It's not, you know, what they would do if they could build their own planet. Mm-hmm. It's what they will do on this planet if given half an opportunity, right? And so, you know, covering those conventions and the ledge over the years, you know, I think the scales fell off of my eyes fairly quickly. You know, certainly by 2013, when Wendy Davis did her sort of famous abortion filibuster in the Texas legislature, after a session in which the media had repeatedly been assured that Texas Republicans were not going to attempt to pass anything abortion related. You know, I thought, well, they're just lying. They just are lying. And, you know, many of my colleagues across the media on the left and the right and in the middle have a tendency to take Republicans at their word. And, you know, that disturbed me in 2013, but I think it became a really evident problem in 2016 with the rise of Trump. And ever since then, right, this sort of normalization that we are dealing with a Republican Party that's like maybe a little wacky, but basically on the level and like regular Democrats, right? Instead of a Republican Party that is like living its best, most crazy life at this point, right? Like is achieving win after win in terms of policy. You have Trump taking over the RNC, right? We have an insurrection supporter on the Supreme Court, right? You know, we're dealing with like true threats to democracy. And we also have Joe Kahn at the New York Times saying, well, we can't cover them as threats to democracy because that would be biased. And,
which,
you know,
you know, if they just looked and you detail some of these, you know, some of these things that that were seen as crazy at the time. Oh, this is just the craziest, the fringiest part of the Republican Party. They were actually documented. You know, the bathroom bill in 2016 that eventually became law, the attacking trans athletes that eventually was turned into law. All of these things were in the GOP platform. Constitutional carry of firearms, that became a reality in 2021, you describe. So it's right there before us. And yet, you know, we even have great, otherwise great media outlets, and I agree with you regard to the Texas Tribune. They're great, but quote a famous non-Texan George W. Bush, they seem to be misunderestimating these documents year after year, and I'm wondering why you think that is. Even, you know, good outlets like Texas Tribune.
I think that, I mean, the phrase that continues to sort of come into my head over and over is normalization bias. I think that it's very difficult to come to grips with the true terrors of our political reality because they are outrageous. I mean, it is outrageous for Samuel Alito to be flying an upside down American flag at his home, right? Like that is outrageous. It's outrageous for Trump to foment an insurrection. It's outrageous for insurrectionists to storm the US Capitol. These things are outrageous. And so I think that there's a sense among members of the media, especially members of the mainstream media, that if they can strive to pursue the maintenance of objectivity and normalization, that things will somehow even out on their own and that they won't be asked to truly describe the world as it is, right? They won't be asked to go into this like sort of uncomfortable place of appearing biased when in fact they would simply be describing reality.
Facts,
but the,
yeah.
Facts, right? But, you know, American journalism is so rooted in this conceit of objectivity, right? And is so beholden to this idea. And unfortunately, the practitioners of American journalism have historically been people from comfortable or middle-class backgrounds who can afford to sort of consider themselves observers above the fray, right? And we're so lucky that now the industry is changing somewhat, and that is mostly at the, you know, due to the hard work of journalists of color and women journalists and queer journalists. But it's not changing fast enough. The industry remains dominated by people who have a really outdated idea of what kinds of work the media can do. And folks who are interested in the preservation of the status quo via journalism, which in my opinion is itself a form of activism, but that's a whole other conversation. But, you know, we see this with the takeover of the Daily Beast and the Washington Post, right? Like, those are, just this week, we saw them rehelmed by demonstrably right-wing editors from across the pond. And that is somehow considered normal and objective, but describing Donald Trump as a fascist is not. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, well, it's really, yeah.
It, well, it seems like they are out of step. It seems like they haven't learned the lessons. I mean, I think it's fair to say that, you know, once upon a time, those editors might have been right when they were talking, for example, about these party platforms, that they really were just statements of ideals by the party's, you know, fringiest members in many cases, but that that has all changed in certainly in the era of Trump. But I might suggest going back to when you began covering these things, you know, with the Tea Party. Now that I think of it, once you started covering these things, Andrea Grimes, everything went to hell. Not to blame you specifically. But shouldn't it been in all of those years, it were, you know, we're talking about 15 years at this point, shouldn't the people in power, you know, be realizing, hey, things are changed. Maybe we need to change the way we cover these politics.
Absolutely. You know, and I think you're really correct in teasing out that this, a lot of this, like, current era's sins originated with the Tea Party and in that initial Tea Party era. And if we're going to talk about that, the most valuable starting point, I think, is to acknowledge that the Tea Party existed specifically as a reaction to the first Black president, right? So there's a movement now that has grown into Trumpism, but which started as a white, racist, reactionary political movement to a Black president, right? And, you know, I don't think it's any secret that America has trouble identifying racism and racist behavior when we see it. You know, I think journalism has a similar problem, right? I think that there were editors and reporters in 2009, 2010, 2011, 2013 that were also unwilling to name racism as the sin at the heart of the Tea Party movement, right? We wanted those people to be ridiculous. We wanted them to be bonkers. We wanted them to be anything but what they repeatedly told us they were, which is mad about a Black president.
Well, and I'll go further to say that going back even farther, we were down there on the ground in Crawford, Texas, back in 2005, reporting from that when talk about the heat in Texas now, it was really bad that week, too. And, you know, I saw a lot of the same people who are now furious, angry, we would consider to be, you know, MAGA Trump supporters, who were back then furious, angry Donald Trump supporters. And I'm not sorry, not Donald Trump, we're George W. Bush supporters back then. And, you know, you had the media even back then saying, well, we need to be fair and balanced here. They have their opinion about the war. You have your opinion about the war. But it seems like, I mean, we're going on 25 years now. How long will it take these guys in the establishment, you know, corporate media to figure it out and to figure out this is not just, you know, one side says this, one side says that. I mean, is there any equivalent? Have you ever seen in a Democratic Party platform any sort of equivalent to the radicalism that does come to pass from these Republican Party platforms?
No, not at all. And you know, what's really sort of like grinds my gears about the thing especially is that Democrats, true party Democrats, people who consider themselves Democrats, the kinds of people who would go to a Democratic convention, mm-hmm. tend to be, even if they are sort of personally pretty politically left, they tend to be quite centrist in their approach to policy building because they are tend to be consensus builders, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. They tend to be aware that the farthest left among them are not going to and perhaps shouldn't dictate the majority of the policy of the party's priorities, right? Which is the precise inverse of the Republican Party, which is that the farthest right person they can find makes the rules, mm-hmm. right? You know, so from Democrats, and, you know, we see this at a national level too. You know, we've historically seen reticence to talk about abortion in plain language. Mm-hmm. We've seen some appalling and atrocious policies on immigration. We saw a delay to support gay marriage and gay rights. Mm-hmm. You know, we've really seen Dems be reticent to embrace some pretty common sense, like right side of history stuff, historically, even in their policy platforms. Yeah. And, you know, there's just it's exactly inverse on the Republican side.
And yet the Republican side is the one describing the left as the radical left.
I wish. I would dearly love for the left to do anything that we have been accused
radical.
Of doing.
Yeah. I mean, the radical on the left was Joe Biden, who ended up being the guy to sort of push everyone towards marriage equality. That's your left wing radical, Joe Biden, really? Mm-hmm. Anyway, we got to get out of here. But the I guess the most difficult question is, you know, what, if anything, is the curative to all of this? For now, we'll just stick with Texas. But, you know, if Texas Republicans succeed in the one party rule that they are working toward, and other states follow Texas and do the same, I mean, it seems to me like it will be largely too late at that point for any such curative. No?
It may be, but I do think that we have a while to go before we really get to that point. And we have, of course, a highly consequential election coming up in but 5 months. So, you know, my recommendations are for folks in Texas or for folks who are outside of Texas who want to stem this tide, donate to grassroots local organizations that are working directly with folks. So abortion funds, racial defense funds, immigrant defense funds, you know, those sorts of things. Get out the vote efforts for specific candidates, you know, like mm-hmm. follow your local news, see who's running. Stuff as small as like school board, county commissioners, you know, races like that ultimately really matter because that's also where a lot of true progressives begin their careers.
Right.
So, you know, if folks want to make change, of course, it's interesting to and funny sometimes to watch Colin Allred drag Ted Cruz because he's horrible. But that's not the only race in Texas. And there are just so many great organizations on the ground here. And, you know, they all need money. They all need funding. And we could really use it.
People need to pay attention. Andrea Grimes is trying to help them pay attention. She writes at MSNBC this week, quote, "There are many, many horrors to behold in the latest platform, and they must be taken seriously, not in spite of how terrifying the document is, but because of how terrifying it is. It is because the latest Texas GOP platform endorses prohibiting the teaching of sex education, sexual health, or sexual choice or identity that we should take it seriously. It is because the platform equates abortion and murder that we should take it seriously. It is because the platform aims to ban any Democrat and indeed any non-compliant Republican from ever holding statewide office that we should take it seriously." Well, you certainly got my attention, Andrea. I will vow to take it as seriously as possible. We'll see if the rest of the state and national media begin to do so as well, to see it as seriously as I think we all clearly should. Andrea Grimes, her work can be found at her own blog, starting with her own blog, homewiththearmadillo.blog. You can also find her on a whole bunch of other places like damemagazine.com, on the Twitters at Andrea Grimes, and even on TikTok at underscore Andrea Grimes, where you can find out what hot possums are. Andrea, a delight speaking with you. Hope you don't mind if we bother you in the near future to come back and join us anytime.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure. Thanks so much, y'all.
Thank you.
Well, now I want to find out what a hot possum is.
Or do you?
I'm not sure, actually.
We'll find out. That's over at TikTok. Enjoy. Hey, this just in before we get out here. An appeals court has halted the Georgia election interference case against Donald Trump and others while it reviews the lower court judge's ruling allowing Fulton County District Attorney Fonnie Willis to remain on the case. That's the state appeals court in Georgia. The Georgia Court of Appeals order on Wednesday prevents Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee from moving forward with the pretrial motions as he had planned while Donald Trump's appeal is pending. While it was already unlikely the case would go to trial before November, the general election, when Trump is expected to be the Republican nominee for president, this makes that even more certain, says AP. A Fulton County grand jury in August indicted Trump and 18 others, accusing them of participating in a sprawling scheme to try and steal the 2020 election. In Georgia, four defendants have pleaded guilty, but Trump and others have pleaded not guilty. It's one of the four criminal cases against Trump. The appeals court on Monday docketed the appeals filed by Trump and eight others and said that if oral arguments is requested and granted, it is tentatively scheduled for October 4. The court will then have until mid-March to rule, and the losing side will then be able to appeal to the Georgia Supreme Court. So that case, it looks like, is also not going to be going to trial anytime soon. Trump and eight other defendants had tried to get Willis and her office removed from the case, arguing that a romantic relationship she had with a special prosecutor created a conflict of interest. McAfee, the judge in March, found that no conflict of interest existed that should force her off the case, but he granted the request from Trump and others to seek an appeal of his ruling from the State Court of Appeals, which now has. All right, we got to get out. My thanks again to Andrea Grimes, journalist and activist, to Desi Doyen, our producer, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, you can download it for free anytime and share it with anyone you like. That's made possible by those of you kind enough to donate to our efforts via bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. Love to hear from you. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. See you there. Until we see you here next time, hopefully tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.